Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is author Graham Farmelo. He's a fellow at Churchill College at the University of Cambridge, an affiliated professor at Northeastern University, and is a regular visitor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And we're talking about his new book, The Universe Speaks in Numbers, How Modern Math Reveals Nature's Deepest Secrets. Graham, I should say welcome back after too long a time. It's a pleasure to be talking with you again.
It's great to talk to you again, Mark.
This is a fascinating book. And for people who are interested in science and the concepts of science, I would strongly recommend this book. This is a book about the cross-fertilization of mathematics and physics, something that's called physical mathematics. Mm-hmm. And with often math giving physicists sort of the direction or the tools to explore new theories.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very interesting idea, and an idea that I don't think a lot of people are familiar with.
Yeah, and I might say the exact opposite is also true. They're both equally true.
It is true.
Physics also helps mathematicians in their research, which is even more surprising. I know several leading mathematicians who cannot understand how that can be true. So you've got physics and math in this in divine embrace. This divine marriage where each are enriching each other in ways that they don't actually fully understand, but it works. They're both amazingly rich in their power to stimulate each other.
But this is a way of doing science that's not without controversy. And as a matter of fact, in the very early sections of your book, Albert Einstein, pure thought can grasp reality as the ancient dreams, but then Robert Oppenheimer goes, Einstein was completely cuckoo.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, Einstein was one of the first people to say that, or to assert rather, that it was really a good idea to take the best theories we have and to explore the mathematics of that theory, and that could possibly help us look at the way ahead. I mean, do you want me to talk more about the example he did, or would you like?
Well, let's lay the groundwork first. I mean,
sure.
This is really about theoretical physics that's getting to a point where perhaps only mathematics can push it forward, not observation and the results of experiments.
Mm-hmm. Well, If I could just wheel it back, that's perfectly accurate what you say. Let me just put it like this, that the argument is that nature is speaking to us in stereo. Everybody knows, right, that nature speaks to us through experiments and observations. We all know that. We all know that these great experimenters, they make measurements on nature, and they don't just do that for the fun of it. They do it because it has been found that these measurements they make on a whole bunch of things, charge, mass, speed, viscosity, all these hundred things, there are patterns among those measurements. Right now, those patterns are encoded in what we call laws of nature. There are connections between things that you might not thought were connected. Now, Einstein put it this way, I think rather brilliantly. He said about 3 years before he died that the central miracle of the universe is that there is an underlying order.
Mm.
Now, and that's another way of saying that there are discoverable laws of nature that connect these quantities together, right? We don't know why that is, but it sure as hell is true. This is what physical science is about. Now, you just look at another compartment of human knowledge, the mathematicians. They're also working on an order, the patterns of ideas that constitute their subject. That's what mathematicians work on in the brilliant statement of G.H. Hardy, the great mathematician in the 1930s. Basically, they're working on on beautiful ideas that connect perfectly with one another. Now, the amazing thing called by Frank Yang, the great theoretical physicist, the miracle of miracles, is that the patterns that are being studied by mathematicians are extremely helpful to the patterns that are investigated by physicists. And as I said earlier, by the same token, the patterns that the physicists find are very helpful to mathematicians. So what it means...
It's almost eerie.
Excuse me?
It's almost eerie.
It is. It is. I mean, and it's worth saying that nobody has a cast iron explanation for why this is. But the truth is, as the great English theoretician put it, the mathematicians are playing a game where they invent the rules. Physicists are playing a game where nature gives them the rules and physicists have to guess them. What is amazing is that the rules that mathematicians find interesting are the very ones that physicists need to describe the order at the heart of nature. So the mathematics and physics are being thrown together in this amazingly productive way.
I've done interviews with theoretical mathematicians over the years, and I remember doing an interview about the monster.
The monster group.
Yep. And there was a sense like these mathematicians worked on this very abstract problem, and there was a sense there is no way in God's green earth this is going to have any application to the actual physical universe.
Well remembered. And my colleague down the corridor, Freeman Dyson, in his usual, perhaps contrarian way, said, "This is so beautiful, it's got to have something to do with nature." And what happens? You know, not 10 years later, the string theorists, among the physicists, find that the monster group is indeed relevant to one of their theories that they're developing. Absolutely amazing.
It's weird. It's now, I want to mention that this is also a sort of in an interestingly personal history, because you have had conversations with many of the players, especially in the second half of the book.
Yes, that's right. Well, I ought to say personally that I have to admit that when I was a student of theoretical physics, this is further back than I care to remember, that I thought all this mathematical stuff would just go away. I thought this is just too complicated. There is no way that the universe is so complicated that you need all this mathematics. And then gradually my resistance has been worn away, and now I'm as convinced as the leading figures in the field that these things really are inextricably linked. And I, through lots of good fortune and luck, I have come to know quite a few of the leading players among the theoreticians and the mathematicians, and I've talked to a lot of them about this amazing harmony. About 100 years ago, it was a byword in Göttingen in Germany, where the great mathematicians and physicists, or many of them, were. Well, they were talking about the pre-established harmony between physics and mathematics. Notice there's no explanation of it, but it seemed to be pre-established in some mysterious way. And that's a term that keeps coming up among mathematicians and physicists today.
It's interesting. The book starts with way back with Sir Isaac Newton.
Yep.
And then it starts to get really, really interesting with people like Clerk Maxwell, who still has resonance in physics and math today.
Oh, very much so. Now, he's my favorite Scot. there's lots of great ones, but he is the king, in my opinion. I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't make it a gender issue. James Clerk Maxwell was to electricity and magnetism what Newton was to gravity.
Right.
What Newton is revered so much in our subject because he was the first person to set up what Einstein called the first workable comprehensive system of theoretical physics. He found a way, right, where using the language of mathematics and a simple law of gravity, you could make testable predictions about the way the cosmos functioned, the tides, the motion of planets and satellites, the moon and what have you, and you could compare those with the most accurate data. And, of course, it was brilliantly validated, and we now know that this gravitational force works. It is a unifying thing that applies to an apple that you might drop at your right in front of you, right through to our planet held in gravitational orbit around the sun. Now, what Maxwell did quite a bit later. This is, we're talking about the 1850s now, roughly around the time of the American Civil War, actually. It's a pretty good way to locate it. He took actually an even a more challenging topic, which was to take all the experiments on electricity and magnetism, and there were hundreds and hundreds of them, and they and pulled them together in one theory set out in the language of math, and that's what he did brilliantly. And much of my book is about how that theory has been so amazingly productive. Richard Feynman,
absolutely
a great
amazing
American theoretician, yep, said that of all the things that happened in the 19th century, that Maxwell theory was the most consequential, right? Because just look at the stuff around us today. Everything in electricity, from our cell phones, our computers, the mains electricity, and that theory of Maxwell sits underneath all that activity. Absolutely amazing.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is author Graham Farmelo. He is a fellow at Churchill College at the University of Cambridge, an affiliated professor at Northeastern University, and a regular visitor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, where he is right now. And we're talking about his new book. It's really interesting. The Universe Speaks in Numbers: How Modern Math Reveals Nature's Deepest Secrets. One of the terms when we first talked, you talk about equations being beautiful. Mm. And for people who are math adverse, they may not understand what you're talking about. When you use the term beautiful, there's a lot of thought about what you're talking about. Give me some examples and talk about what you mean.
Right. Okay, it was a perfectly reasonable question. It means something like the beauty that you see in for example, a great painting or a great poem. It means that there is a sense that everything in that work, a work of art, has a place. There's nothing that you can just cast aside, and it would make no difference. A sense that it could be no other way. That it was somehow meant to be. You know, like a great movie or a great poem or a great painting. A sense of harmony. Right.
It's almost like a gut feeling, but based on an intelligent analysis.
Yes.
In other words,
so
you have
yes
a background, but there's
yep
a gut feeling, there's a sense
yes
that this has got to be right.
That's right.
Well, let me give you an example.
Sure.
The Yang-Mills gauge symmetry.
Mm.
As you write in your book, the idea looked beautiful, but it seemed to have nothing to do with the real world.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, that was a generalization of that Maxwell theory of electromagnetism. What I mean by that is that the Maxwell theory, which has worked so beautifully, it could be put in a larger context that was even more beautiful by Yang and Mills. And yet, Yang was Chinese-born but later American citizen, Robert Mills an American citizen. It seemed that nature didn't seem to have that symmetry underneath it, but some 20 years later, it turned out that yes, if with the right interpretation of the math, it really did have an amazing ability to describe stuff going on right in the core of atoms, which is absolutely amazing.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Now, there was a time, and you talk about this as the long divorce, where physics and math didn't seem to associate, and that was in the 20th century.
Yeah, that is right. It's perfectly correct to say that the relationship between physics and math has not been one long, untroubled mutual admiration society. There was a time, roughly speaking, after the Second World War, for about 15 years or so, where the physicists could get on quite happily on their own without doing fancy math, and the mathematicians could get along without taking much notice of the theories that the physicists were discovering. So they did function quite well. Here at the Institute here, the mathematicians and physicists would eat at separate tables. They didn't need to talk to each other very much. That was fine. Now they can't get enough of each other, right? And that happened when there are two things, really, that happened. First of all, when we came out with those theories called gauge theory, based on the Yang-Mills thing you were talking about. Don't worry about these names. They're only names, right? But we had a theory powered its way to the forefront in the early 1970s that showed us how the forces responsible for holding together the every atom, that they have a certain symmetry that had been identified some 20 years before, and that was full of promising math, and the math that put the physicists in touch with the mathematicians, and it was as if people, it were two, I mean, the great mathematician Michael Atiyah put it this way to me, I think brilliantly, shortly before he died, that it was as if there were two groups burrowing away, the physicists burrowing away, and mathematicians burrowing away, and what happened in the early 1970s was those tunnels intersected. And they had to shake hands and learn how to speak each other's language. It was an absolutely miraculous time. And that's where the physicists and mathematicians really got together. And with the advent of more advanced theories, known as string theory, that relationship has become even more intense. So since the 1970s, it really has been the most passionately intense of marriages.
There's an array of important people in your book, and I just want to pay attention to a couple of them. Freeman Dyson, who you mentioned, is one of these people, it sort of seems, in that century, in the 20th century, was one of the first to be, he excelled at both mathematics and physics.
That's correct, yeah.
And so was able to bring the two together. He seems like one of the key people.
Yeah, well, Freeman Dyson, a great figure. He's often said to me that he has two talents: writing essays and doing calculations, which is grossly modest. because he is a great essayist, but he's a very fine mathematician and a very fine physicist. And as you say, that gave him this ability to see that physicists and mathematicians can work together. But, you know, it was even a surprise to Freeman. I know that he's told me this many times. When that marriage, when the long divorce ended and they remarried in the 70s, that was a wonderful thing for him, because he saw those two communities, which had long been separate, pulled together. And I might say the math got too hairy, even for him. He said that, my goodness, I'm too old now to study this. This is really very advanced stuff. But he has written brilliantly and was fantastically helpful to me in demonstrating how, if you go back to Newton's time, that the interplay between mathematics and physics has been so productive. And as you rightly say, now as we speak, there are relatively few clues coming from the heart of the atom that help physicists develop their theories. But what we can do is seek inspiration from mathematics,
right.
And we believe that that's taking us along a good path.
Just as an aside, one of the things I loved and I learned from your book of many things, Freeman Dyson talks about scientists as either birds or frogs.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you know what he means by that? He means that there are let's take the bird first of all. These people like to swoop over the landscape, making connections that other people can't see because they're so high above it. You know, they're freewheeling and doing all those creative things. A frog is a person who's quite content to just go from one stone to another, one problem to another, and just solve them one at a time and ply their trade in that way. So you could think about the classic bird would be Einstein, the British physicist Paul Dirac, the mathematician Michael Atiyah. These are big thinkers who like to just go over the terrain at a very, very high level. Now, a frog, right, you could still be a superb physicist or mathematician if you're a frog, and one of those is Freeman Dyson himself.
Right. Yep.
He was a problem solver. He did not feel particularly comfortable looking at the whole terrain, overlooking it like that. But what Freeman did brilliantly for decades was actually solve these individual problems using his skills in his own way. They're both valuable. It's very, very important to say that. But it has to be said, and this may not be just, but we honor the birds most. You know, we honor people like Einstein, and in the latter day, the British cosmologist Stephen Hawking. He was very much a bird-type figure as well.
It's interesting. Time and again in your book, relatively new fields of mathematics eventually lead to new theoretical ideas in physics. And I want to talk about two ideas, topology and group theory.
Mm.
Both of those were mathematical ideas and fields, actually.
Yep.
And it wasn't until much later that all some sort of physicists started to look at it and go, wow, you know, yep, some of the things that you're doing in there would be applied to here.
Yeah. Well, the topology one is really important. Now, let's say what topology means. That's about shape. It's about the properties of things that remain unchanged when you squeeze them, twist them, and do other things to them, but don't rip them apart, right? So it's about the shapes of things. Now, that was looked at by mathematicians way back in the early 19th century, just out of curiosity. I mean, you know, what happens when you take these weird and wonderful shapes in abstract space and twist them and deform them and what have you? But it was James Clerk Maxwell who saw, who was one of the first people to see how relevant that could be in looking at the shapes of fields, electric and magnetic fields. And that was absolutely critical in his development of his theory of electricity and magnetism. And you go ahead a century on, and topology, that study of shape, is now absolutely central to the training of a modern theoretical physicist. I might say that when I trained, I was never taught topology. We barely looked at it when I was a student, right? And that was true of all the students I met all across America and Europe and elsewhere. Now it's 101. It's stuff you have to do, right? Because people are looking at the shapes of these fields, and what they're doing is building on the great insights of Maxwell and others in the early 1970s.
It's amazing the number of ideas that are now. And I'm sure the public has heard of them, ideas like supersymmetry, string theory, magnetic monopoles. And these are things that all have their origins in mathematics, and it's only when physicists start to look at the math that they directed the experimentation towards finding about these fields.
Well, the way I put it is that we've talked about how this astonishing, I think you could call it a revolution in the 1970s, when this theory, which was a development of Maxwell's theory, came to be developed, which showed that the forces that operate within atoms can be described by what are called gauge theories. Now, when you explore the mathematics of that, you get these amazing things called magnetic monopoles. Mm-hmm. Right, which we're all taught at school shouldn't exist. We're all taught north and south magnetic poles always come together. They're always in pairs, and it turns out that it was first discovered by Paul Dirac in 1931. But in modern theories, they must exist. They really must exist. But nobody's actually found them. But they are absolutely part and parcel of these modern theories. And there are other things, kind of events that you see on a subnuclear scale called instantons that also crop up. Mm-hmm. And it's the mathematics of those things that is incredibly rich and has not just been rich and productive for physicists, but also, as you say, for mathematicians. This is really, really important stuff.
Now, I just want to, again, to sort of give a voice to the people who, physicists who are worried about the mathematics now.
Yeah.
There's
a
quote, and this is a quote from your book, "Do mathematics and aesthetics supplant and transcend mere experiment?" Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there are physicists who are alive today who believe physics is in a, quote, dark mathematical forest.
Yes.
How do you answer that?
Well, the first thing to say is, let's be really clear, that physicists, their job description is to understand the order in nature, right? It is answerable to nature. It deals in descriptions that make predictions, and they must be tested against the most accurate experiments. Any physicist worth his or her salt signs up to that. Now, everyone should agree on that. The question is, how do you make progress when there are relatively few clues coming from the atom smashers, for example, the one at CERN,
right,
and relatively few clues, there are some very important ones, though, it's worth saying, from cosmology and what have you. They're very hard won now, these clues that enable us to take forward our best theories. Now, my answer to those people, first of all, is they fundamentally, let's just try to establish some common ground. I do believe that there are some very good practitioners who can get carried away with the mathematics. Right, the mathematics is beautiful, and you can just get carried away for it. Rather like, in a way, if I could draw an analogy, I remember in the 1970s, when I was a student, people got carried away with the joy of computing, and they'd leave physics and go into computing. You see what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And you can get physicists now who are so entranced with mathematics that they could get sidetracked, so to speak, or start to believe that the mathematics is more central to them than understanding nature. So I believe that is a legitimate concern. But, this is the big but, so many of the very smartest physicists who've got their feet on the ground, who are looking very carefully at clues, but there aren't any at the moment, they are enormously encouraged, right, by the fact that the two central theories of modern physics, quantum theory and relativity, absolutely fundamental. Quantum theory for the theory of matter on the smallest scale, relativity, the improvement of Newton's account of space and time. When you jam quantum theory and relativity together, then you get the most amazing predictions, right, or the most amazing consequences, including these amazing links with mathematics. Now, it's based on those two theories, which I want to stress have never, ever been refuted by experiment, that those are the twin guides that are taking us forward. The developments in gauge theories, the developments in string theories, they are all fundamentally based on those two theories, which are incredibly well grounded in experiment. Yes, there is a faith, that is absolutely true, that this mathematics is taking us in the right direction. It is, for people who are really expert in this, they see almost a miracle in the way that string theory holds up. Yes, there are definitely problems, huge problems, with testing that theory, which seeks to give an account of all the fundamental forces of nature. But math appears to be a self-consistent way of taking that theory forward. I think I would say one thing. Yes, mathematics is incredibly useful. It's incredibly productive. But in the end, we must be answerable to experiment. And I tell you now, I think it's accurate to say that most physicists would give a disposable internal organ to have another great clue from nature. We really want them, right? For the time being, we have, unfortunately, in some sense, unfortunately, to be guided by math. But please, please, let's have another clue from nature that gets us back on a path where we really know that we're on the most solid of territory.
We are completely out of time, and we've barely scratched the surface of this book. We could talk about this book for years. I mean, all the individual personalities, ideas, and that. My guest tonight has been author Graham Formello. He's a fellow at Churchill College at the University of Cambridge, an affiliated professor at Northeastern University, and is a regular visitor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, where he is right now. We're talking about his new book. It's really good. The Universe Speaks in Numbers: How Modern Math Reveals Nature's Deepest Secrets. Graham, it's been a real pleasure.
Likewise, Mark. A real pleasure to talk to you too.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.